will conduct this rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is a rain replay.
I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with this rain report. Last week, we brought you an excerpt from a 2013 Dayton Hamvention talk by ARRL lab manager Ed Hare, W1RFI, speaking on the universally troubling topic of power line interference. This week, we resume Ed's talk, beginning with his most appropriate query.
How many people have a problem with power line noise right now? Okay, we got a busy room. What you want to first do is learn what you can about power line noise, because you really want to differentiate between power line noise and other types of noise sources that could be causing you the problems. Keep a log of your power line noise, as much information as you can provide about time of day, relating to weather. If you have patterns in this, that may help you figure out what it is. We've had some cases recently of devices that seem to come on a timer operating about 16 hours a day. And after a little bit of troubleshooting, we found that these are associated with high-powered fluorescent light controllers being used in some form of indoor gardening. Now, what? It could be vegetables. We don't know. I mean, we have grow lights in my house. My wife has all these plants in the kitchen. In some cases, it is other types of crops. What we found is we've managed to test a few of these devices, and we're finding them to be operating about 30 dB over the FCC limits. Now, we had one case in California where we had a local consultant who apparently spoke the same language as the farmer. They went off and had a really good talk, and the farmer agreed that he'd send us the light that he was using so we could test it. The idea, of course, is we were not going to make a federal case out of the farmer. He went off and bought a different light that was a lot quieter. We were happy. But you can find a lot of different types of noise sources. So keeping a good log of that can really be helpful. And if you're going to deal with a power company, you're going to deal with a neighbor, try to stay calm, cool, and collected. Because a lot of times these power cases really get out of hand. By the time we hear them, bad words have been flying in all directions, bad words between amateurs and neighbors. So the best thing you can do is to just try to approach this as diplomatically as you possibly can. Now, if you're a utility as one of the good guys, you're going to be going directly through the utility. You don't need ARRL to get involved with that. We have limited staff time, so we want to work on the ones that won't get fixed. You're going to call their normal customer service channels. Keep a record of any case numbers that they give you, who you spoke with, what dates, what time. And with the good guy utilities, these will be handled in a reasonably timely fashion. Now, understand reasonable is also in the eyes of the beholder. If you're going to have a case where you call the customer service agent, it's going to take at best several days for them to schedule anybody to look at it. They'll send out a troubleshooter who then has to schedule a repair crew out there. This is not necessarily all that easy. And, if the hospital across town loses power, well, they're going to put your case on hold and take care of the major power outages. Even in the best of cases, if you get something resolved in 2 or 3 weeks, you've done really well by the way these things go. Well, not all people are this lucky. How many people have contacted their utility and had things go poorly? And if it doesn't go well, what you're apt to find is some of those other middle ground areas where a utility would like to help you, but they come out, they're going to be using the wrong equipment, the wrong techniques. There's a lot of things that they can do. What I would recommend in that case is if you have a utility that's trying to work with you, you're usually going to be much better off to continue that process than to try to get the FCC involved. Because if you have local people working on this problem, if we get the FCC involved, the first thing that happens with that FCC letter, it goes to the company attorney. And now you have the company attorney going to be managing this case, usually with the idea that his or her job is to get the utility completely off the hook from all responsibility, and that often will grind things to a halt. We're willing on our end to provide them with all the information we have about what they can do. We can point them to the correct resources. RFI services, for example, will go off for a fee and find these noises for companies. They can even get out there with their equipment, get Mike Gruber on the phone, and Mike will answer their questions. I mean, we really, really want to resolve these. The utility, however, really fumbles around endlessly, gives it a really half-hearted effort over the period of a month or two. At that point, it's really ready for some additional help. And then the ARRL has worked out a cooperative agreement with the FCC where we're going to take the first cut at some of these cases, where we'll contact the utility on behalf of the amateur, provide them with a whole pile of information that would tell them what to do, provide them with information about the rules, and some of them actually do respond to that when they get that letter from the league and try to move things forward and get the cases resolved. Our role is primarily technical. The technical solutions may resolve a case before we get FCC involvement. If all that fails, there's little choice but to send a case to the FCC. We have Laura Smith of the FCC geared up to take these cases. And then at that point, we have well documented the fact that amateurs have tried to resolve this with the utility. Reasonable time has been given for the utility to do it. And then we can outline the ways in which we believe the utility failed to meet its obligations under the rules. This is not a fast and easy solution. This literally can take months. So again, if the utility will work with you, that may be faster. What happens first is we send an advisory letter. The FCC has asked that we give them 60 days to try to resolve the problem. They don't want to hear from us again until 2 months have gone by. The FCC then sends an advisory letter, worded remarkably like ours, same reasons we worked with them to try to get the language. And then if need be, they'll do a follow-up window with a letter with kind of a variable window on the kind of responses they're looking at. So this is a case that literally going as best as it possibly can might take at least 3 months to get resolved. Not good news for amateurs, but you know, this is something the FCC has kind of hammered out in its own mind is a reasonable way to try to get these things done, knowing that utilities can't just fix some of these problems at the drop of a hat. If that doesn't work, the FCC cannot issue an enforcement only on a complaint. It then needs to send that to the local field office for investigation. Now, this shows you a list of some of the companies that have received FCC letters. It's quite the list. The list on our new webpage is even larger.
You're listening to a 2013 Hamvention Talk by Ed Hare, W1RFI, lab manager for the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League. We'll conclude our second excerpt from his Powerline presentation in a moment. This is the Rain Report, available on 160 meters, Saturday nights from Wentzville, Missouri, on 1860 kHz in magnificent amplitude modulation, AM, as part of the WA0RCR 160-meter Gateway Radio newsletter. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
Utilities have responses that are all over the map. In some cases, they've ignored the FCC. We've had a few citations without forfeiture, but at this point, no notice of apparent liability or forfeitures have been issued. Now, it's our position, and we've been hammering this to the FCC, stronger enforcement really would help send a message to utilities. We really will try to keep working and resolving these cases. We're not looking to make an example of anybody. There's plenty that are good examples despite our best efforts. And the analogy is, you know, one traffic cop doesn't catch every speeder, but because you know that cop might be out there, you're probably going to speed a little bit less, trying to see just how much over the speed limit you can actually go. We've had some really good successes, and we've had some really bad failures in trying to get these things resolved. In one case here in Lubbock, Texas, there were two involved utilities in that case. The FCC went out and identified over 50 noise sources and told the utility, you must fix these. The utility was not happy, but they really pushed the process right to the wall. And that's certainly one of our victories. We've had another one where the FCC went out with the wrong equipment, wrong types of spectrum analyzer and a little loop antenna, and determined that noise that was reported by the amateur as over S9 wasn't present and that it wasn't harmful interference. Now, the remarkable part of this tale, both of those were this case in Lubbock, Texas. We had one FCC investigator did not know what he was doing, went off and did everything wrong. When we kept pressing the issue 6 months later, the second guy went out, did everything right, found the noise sources. So even the FCC has trouble really identifying and characterizing power line noise properly. The second guy did it right. The first guy really flubbed it. And we have other similar examples. Now, some of these cases have dragged on for years. Mike, what's our longest running case right now? Yeah, over 10 years. I mean, you know, very persistent amateurs. We love them because it lets us really continue at this. Some hams have dropped out and just given up. A few of them have actually died before their power line noise got corrected. And utilities often spend orders of magnitude more time not finding power line noise than it would take to fix it. Mike went off to a convention once, gave a talk on power line noise, and when the question and answer happened, some guy raised his hand. Hi, Mike, I'm one of your complainants. I live 15 miles from here. And Mike thought about the joy it would be to spend the next day standing at the league booth, so he said to the guy, how would you like me to take all this equipment out to your house and we'll find your power line noise problem? Mike gets there. stops in the driveway, unpacks the stuff, says, let me show you how this works. He turns on the receiver. There's this loud buzz coming out of it. He takes the directional antenna. He points it at the pole right outside the guy's house, clearly identifies that as the noise source. Now, this utility had had the FCC involved. It had its company lawyers involved. It had its CEO involved on literally dozens of letters for a problem that was found by Mike Gruber in 5 minutes or less. And that include unpacking the equipment for the box. So they spend a lot of time not fixing problems that sometimes can be found very easily. They're just not competent. They don't know what to do. So when they don't know how to do it, they find all these excuses not to get it done. And utilities really, in my opinion, need more information. We generally don't see this kind of problem with a cable company. They have RF-savvy engineers. The cable industry really has done a much, much better job than the utility industry. Now, the FCC, if all else fails, they're going to go off and do a field investigation. And they have little time available to do it. And these field offices, they have a wide range of technical expertise. And what we've seen, as I just described in Lubbock, Texas, the results have been very, very inconsistent. I really try to avoid having to send cases to the field office, because if a field agent goes out and says, we have determined that this is not harmful interference, we have a problem. We now have to go up with the FCC against the findings of its own engineers. We know better, but that's going to be a really, really hard sell to try to get the commission to do anything once the field says this is not a problem. One of the problems that we have with this is the utilities will go off with the wrong equipment trying to find stuff. And what happens then is they go off and they will find noise. Well, if you hear noise at your amateur station that's coming from a source a half a mile up the road, there might be a number of noise sources in between your station and that actual source that, because of the way they conduct onto the power line noise, you may not hear. So a utility goes out, it finds five noise sources on the line, fixes them, didn't find the actual noise source, you still have noise. They reach the conclusion, well, this guy will never be happy, and they stop working on cases. The real way to do this is with a time domain method. Basically, it's a receiver with a built-in oscilloscope. Mike, you can hold it up. They'll be proud to look at it.
This is a professional-grade instrument that does exactly what Ed said. It's specifically designed for identifying power line noise. It takes some practice and skill, but when you're good at it, you can actually tell how many sources you're looking at and match up a particular source that an amateur is hearing at his station with one that is out in the field or in his neighborhood. And that's a very powerful technique.
Yeah, not only does it find the right source, but it saves the utility company a lot of money from having to fix a bunch of problems that aren't it. So what they basically are going to do is they're going to go take this equipment, put it at your station, capture the noise signature, go off in the world now and look at noises, and if the signatures don't match, move on to the next noise. Mike Martin, K3RFI, RFI Services, does this very, very successfully. He also offers training for utilities. And this shows you an example of the time domain. If you look at the noise source on the top and compare it with the noise source on the bottom, they're different. So that noise source on the top was at your station. The noise source on the bottom is the one that they found a pole a block away. No, there's another noise source, because that's not the same noise. The utility can simply move on. And so they're going to start by looking at the noise at your station. They hook this equipment up to your station antenna. Now, an important thing to remember is the source must be active to find it. This presents problems. In fact, Dave Sumner at the league headquarters had an intermittent noise source. Fortunately, Mike Gruber could spend 5 minutes a day going out of his way on his way to work and see if the source might be active. Mike went there over a period of a couple of weeks, all the equipment loaded in his car. Finally, one day he gets there, the noise source was active at the time, and Mike was able to find the noise source pretty quickly. Now, if the utility were scheduling crews to come up and look at this stuff for something that gets active once or twice a week for 5 minutes, that's going to be a very, very hard thing for them to find and resolve.
This concludes our two excerpts from the 2013 Dayton Hamvention Powerline Presentation by Ed Hare, W1RFI, Lab Manager for the ARRL, the American Radio Relay League. The RAIN Report is copyright 1990-2014 RAIN, all rights reserved. Now for RAIN's founder and producer, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from all of us affiliated with RAIN, the Radio Amateur Information Network, www.therainreport.com.